You've taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And welcome to Force Material, where Baz and I are joined by a very special guest this week. He is a two-time Canadian Screen Awards winner, a Toronto Theatre Critics Award winner, and the lead actor in Kim's Convenience, my favourite sitcom on the air at the moment. It's Mr. Kim himself, star of stage and screen, Paul Sung-Hyung Lee. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me in. Wow, you did a lot of research on me. I'm flattered.
Now, if you're listening to the show, you might be saying to yourself, hey, you know, I love Kim's Convenience as much as the next guy, but what does this have to do with Star Wars? Well as being a great actor, Paul is also a Star Wars geek. He makes his own costumes, he builds his own props. He just started a YouTube channel, Bitter Asian Dude Inc., where he unboxes all his collectibles. Two of them have been Star Wars collectibles so far. So he's a bona fide Star Wars super nerd.
Well, I don't know about super nerd, but I really do love Star Wars. I think there's certain levels of nerddom there, and I think I'm probably mid-tier.
Right,
you know,
yes.
More than just a passing fancy, but not as really fine-tuned in terms of like expanded universe stuff or the big outreach of Star Wars. I'm very original trilogy or tri-trilogy. Somebody tried to quote to me on my YouTube channel, but the trilogy of trilogies, I'm into that. So because that's first and foremost, and of course the different television series
yeah.
out there, the animated ones and the live action ones.
Actually, speaking of the live action shows, mm-hmm. Bass just mentioned to me before we started recording that he heard that you actually visited the set of The Mandalorian. Is that true?
Yeah. Oh my God, what an experience. What a dream come true. For me, Star Wars started when my dad took my sister and I to see it in the movie theaters in 1977. Mm. And that was the beginning of my journey with Star Wars. Just absolutely fell in love with it. Didn't understand what was really going on because I was five. But I knew I just wanted to be in that world. And so, when the original trilogy was done, I grew up with my sister watching it. My dad took us to see Star Wars. My babysitter took my sister and I to see Empire. And then my sister and I went by ourselves to watch Return of the Jedi. And thus began our journey. So it's always had a very, very close spot in my heart. And when the final movies were done, like the prequels were done, I kind of thought, well, that's it. You know, one of your dreams when you're a kid is you want to sort of visit the set, or maybe as an actor, you want to be in it. And there was no way I was going to be in any of the movies, because that all happened in Hollywood, and they shot it in London and all around the world. And I was in Los Angeles for an award ceremony. Kim's had been invited. It was the Unforgettable Gala that the Asian American community puts together, and they celebrate Asian Americans in the media. And we'd been invited down there, and we were watching the award ceremony, and this woman jumped in front of me all of a sudden. She said, "Paul, do you remember who I am?" And I hadn't seen her in close to 25 years, but I recognized her right away. It was my dear friend, Deborah Chow. Now, wow. Deborah, for those of you who don't know, is actually a director on The Mandalorian. She directed three episodes, fantastic episodes. But I hadn't seen her in 25 years, because way back then, I was working, we were both working at the Factory Theatre in Toronto, Ontario. She was part of the arts administrative team there, and I was there on a grant work study sort of program through the government. I'd gotten some grant money to learn arts administration, and that's how we met. And I remember we hit it off really well, and then one day she knew I wanted to be an actor, and I knew she wanted to be a director. And one day she said, "Hey, I'm shooting this short film, do you want to be in it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." So we shot a day around Chinatown. I was like some gumshoe. I had like the trench coat and the fedora, and I was solving some sort of mystery. And then Deborah disappeared. I did, like, you know, the theater actually ended up having to, it was going through bankruptcy period. So mm-hmm. they actually had to shut the doors for a bit. And then Deborah went her way and I went my way. Mm. And I didn't see her again for 25 years till she jumped in front of me. So I asked her what she was doing and what she'd been. And she said, oh, you know, remember that short film? That short film got me into Columbia University in New York. I went, that's fantastic. Mm. She said, I learned to be a filmmaker. I'm a director. I went, that's great. What have you done? And she's, you know, done little shows like Fear the Walking Dead, Better Call Saul, Jessica Jones, little boutique shows, right?
Yeah.
And I said, so what are you working on now? And she said, I'm directing episodes of The Mandalorian. And I almost died. So I grabbed her arm. I said, you can I swear on this thing?
Yeah.
On this podcast? Because I basically said, you're shitting me. He said, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I've been trying to get in touch with you is that Dave Filoni, he's a big fan of Kim's Convenience. Wow. And so, yeah. And so he was thinking about maybe writing something for you. And I almost died. My grip intensified on her arm. And it was one of those moments where everything else fades to black and I'm focused right in on her. And I said, you do realize I have over five, like I have dozens of Star Wars costumes at home right now. She said, you're kidding me. So I sent her my Instagram pictures of me in my Imperial officer's uniform, the TIE fighter outfit, the Rebel pilot outfit, all these. And she said, oh my God, I'm going to send these to Dave. So she texted them to Dave. Mm. And he responded right away. And he basically said, well, he could just wear his costumes to the show if he wants to be in it. And so she said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, oh, I'm flying back to Toronto. She said, oh, you should visit the set. You should come and visit the set. I said, no, I have to go back home. But can I come back and visit? And she said, yes. And so 3 weeks later, I flew back and was in heaven. Like that day, visiting the set of The Mandalorian was dream. I mean, my dreams came true. Mm. And the things that I saw, I can finally talk about it now because I was there when, like, I saw the child being revealed. I mean, to me, it was the scene where they land in Tatooine.
Uh-huh.
And it's Amy Sedaris' scene. I saw her scene, basically.
Wow.
And so I saw, you know, them manipulating the puppet to walk down the gangplank. And I thought, oh, my God. And they're like, no, you can't tell anybody about this. Right. This is like nobody knows about this. And I was like, no one will know about this because I knew even then that as soon as it dropped, the internet was going to melt. Mm. And it did. And it was like, I didn't want to ruin anybody's surprise because that was the reaction to the child being revealed was such a seminal moment, I think, in Star Wars lore up until that point, because it was just this whole like this branching off in a whole new territory. That was exciting. And to be honest, it's been a while since I kind of felt that way about Star Wars. That pure sort of like, we're going in a different direction and this is really, really cool. Mm. And so, yeah, I met Jon Favreau and again, huge fan of him and his work. I mean, I loved him, his stuff from the very beginning when I was like, when he was on Seinfeld and then when he did Swingers, you know, I just fell in love with the guy's work and he's fantastic director, all these hits, you know, from Elf to the chef, and Iron Man and all those other little movies in between, right? So, you know, and he's there and he's bigger than life. And it's just like, I remember standing there on the set and watching and listening to Filoni and Favreau have this discussion about one of the characters. I think they're talking about Mando. Mm. And I had no idea, there's no context, but they were talking about story, which is great. Like what serves the story, you know? And it was just, it's beautiful to see that when you see that sort of collaboration and they care, you can tell they care about it. And again, and I was on the set, the volume is what they call it, that digital set where it is like hundreds of thousands of LED lights in a big, like being projected and the tech behind, and I felt like I was standing outside and that was with the naked eye. Mm-hmm. I mean, on camera, it's one thing you kind of go, well, it's on camera, it's all effects. But when you're standing there and your own eyes are telling you you're outside, that's tremendous. And so to be privy to something like that was life altering, you know? And I felt so lucky, and I spent at least an hour and a half in the props trailer, just chatting up the props department. yes. Shout out to Josh and Yang. Those two are great human beings as well, and really skilled crafts people in terms of, you know, what they bring to the world of prop building. They've since expanded the props department, which is great. And so I was dying. Like every single second was just like soaking in as much as I could, because it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to do something like that. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I heard for that scene where Moff Gideon turns up with all the soldiers, that they put the call out for the 501st to come down in costume that day.
That's so right.
I'm wondering if there's anything like that in the second season. Would they put the call out to you, do you reckon? Would you turn up?
Oh my God. If they did, I'd die. Man, yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding me? It's like, I'll pay you. I'll be down there. It's like that episode of The Simpsons where the, you know, he's bothering the director on set, and the director says, why don't you go to craft services and get some food? And he disappears so quickly, you just see the outline of smoke. That would be me. It's really interesting being on the other side of stuff and looking at the behind the scenes, because as a fan, you know, I've been on the forums, and I you know, when I'm building my own, when I'm constructing my costumes, and I'm looking for guidance in terms of screen accuracy and what color, like that's a big thing. Like, what's the actual color of these trousers? Mm. Is it dark blue or is it gray? Because depending on different light sources and blah, blah, blah. And the debate rages on. And I remember I got a tour, Filoni gave me a tour as well of the studios, and we went to the costume department, and I loved it. Joseph Porro was the costume designer back then for season one. And, you know, I was looking in the room, and they had, basically what happens is all the big pictures, so like Rogue One, they got, and Solo, they got all their props and costumes filtered down because it's all one big company. Mm-hmm. And so they got all this, the movies, the screen use stuff in the movies to use for The Mandalorian. And, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at this whole rack of pants, and they're all like the BDUs, like the Rebel Fleet Troopers, what they have. And the spectrum went from dark blue to light gray all across, and they're all screen used. And so it's like, wow. It's all of them. Like, the answer is yes, it's these colors. But if I were to go online and say no, and say that, I'd be like, people go, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, so many people have their own theories. And it's like, you know, unless you're directly linked to the studio and you take a picture and you show the spectrum of the pants used, right? No one will believe you. And that's a level of fandom that I find fascinating. The attention to detail, and the fact that people will fight to the death to make sure that they have it right. And in fact, they'll get it more accurate than the poor wardrobe department, who's like, you know, when you have the pressures of a shooting day on your shoulders, and there's a million different moving parts, and it's a gigantic set with hundreds of people doing, you know, top-notch work on it. And everybody wants to get it right. Nobody wants to make a mistake. But invariably, hey, that's life. It happens, right? Like the infamous scout troopers, the kneecaps on upside down.
Yeah.
in episode, like, people losing their minds over it, saying, yeah, they should be fired and blah. I kind of go, you know what? I get it. Mm. Nobody wants that to happen. But we're all humans, right? Mm. And it's like, is that really going to distract from your overall enjoyment of a well-told story? It would have been great, but, you know, his kneecaps were on upside down. So can't subscribe to this anymore. I'm out. Sorry, Mandalorian. You know, it's that kind of, like, I get it. And you kind of go, well, that actually is Star Wars, so they should get it right. But there's so many people working on it, so many different references. And, you know, the fact is, a lot of people who are working on the show, it's a job for them. Mm. They might not be huge super nerds and big fans, but they're trained professionals, and they're doing the best that they can under time constraints. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every once in a while, something like that slips through the cracks, and what are you going to do? Right. Mm.
It's just backstory for the troopers involved. It shows that they aren't smart enough to put their kneecaps on the right way around, and the Empire just doesn't hire the best people.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. And the best part is somebody. So I read, and it was such a pithy comment, and I loved it. They said, "Well, you might be screaming it isn't screen accurate, but it is now." And so, because guess what? That's canon.
Exactly.
It's on the screens. I can wear my kneecaps upside down now as a scout trooper, and I think one of the builds I want to sort of tackle next, oh god, add that to the list, is a scout trooper from Mandalorian, because it's sloppy. Like, you can tell this is a ragtag military organization that has fallen far from grace. The discipline is not there, the morale is not there, and you can tell it that it's just falling to pieces. So I thought that was brilliant, that, you know, hey, guess what? Yeah, this isn't regulation for the knee pads to be like this, but I'm gonna flip them upside down because it's more comfortable. I love that. And so if I could be sloppy and messy and sort of have my cummerbund sort of drop below the chest armor, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do that, right? Because it's canon.
So in terms of the costumes that you have made, I mean, what's in your collection? What have you made so far?
Okay. So I started with, I have a TIE fighter pilot. Mm-hmm. And then you can strip that down and be a TIE fighter reserve pilot. It's basically you take off the armor and the helmet and you put on the black cap of the two Imperial officers' uniforms, a staff officer and a line officer. And that's the green versus the black. Mm-hmm. I have a mud trooper from Solo that is so close to being completed. I can taste it, and I just have to rework the connection of the hoses to the mask and to the back, and I have to dye this cape. It's called a Palashka. Mm-hmm. It's got to be dyed black, and I don't have a pot big enough to boil the water, because it's a waterproof rain tent basically that you can wear as a poncho, but right. It's got to be black for whatever reason. I don't want to spray paint it, so I have to dye that, and so then that's done. I have a tank trooper from Rogue One, like the tank commander. Mm-hmm. And you can double up the armor and have the ATAC, like the big the other drivers for the AT-ATs, the cargo transports in Rogue One, so that's 7. And I have an original trilogy TK that I'm almost done.
Yep,
I just got to work on here. Yeah, the thermal detonator on the back. And I've got the shoulder belts for whatever reason are drooping too much, so I got to fix that. I have a First Order TK in a box that's just screaming at me to start working on. And so it's from The Last Jedi. And then I have my, oh my God, I have so many now. my X-Wing pilot costume. And I wanted to, like, from Blue Squadron from Rogue One, I want to get the blue jumpsuit for that. And that's a whole other build. But I think I can recycle reuse the helmet for that. So that's 10. Mm. And then I just got a Darth Vader and Novos helmet, but I don't think I'm going to tackle Vader because I'm too short and too fat. So I'm going to leave that well enough. But what I'm finding is, in terms of costuming, the cooler it looks, the more comfortable it is. And for those of you whose cosplay is as any of the Imperials with the armor pinches, you all know what I'm talking about. When you move around and there's a bit in your inner thigh where your thigh armor just pinches. It's like, I'm glad I have a helmet on because I'm crying because it hurts. So all the Imperial stuff is super cool, but super uncomfortable and hot to wear. The Rebels is actually, it's smart because you can sit down, you have pockets, you can do a lot of things with them. So it's a little bit more bearable to wear. But like the Imperial stuff, I'm a member of the 501st in Canada. Mm. And so, the armor is way more cool looking, but it's there's a price to pay for that because you can't see anything and it's really hard to move.
How do you decide, like, you kind of mentioned with Darth Vader before, you're not sure if it's the right look for you. I mean, do you try and you know, do you look at like which characters or are your favorites and try and, you know, look at making those, or do you look more, do you sort of start more from a point of view of like, okay, what's going to sort of suit me best? Like,
right.
How do you sort of decide, you know, where to start, like what to start making?
For me, it always starts with, oh my God, that looks so cool. Right, like if the design appeals to me aesthetically, I'm like, yes. Mm. I, like that's what happened when I saw the tank trooper, the tank commander in Rogue One. I was like, oh, I love that helmet. I love that armor design. And I thought, you know, like that is so cool. I want that. And he's only got 6 seconds of screen time. And so like when that tweaks my imagination, I'm like, yes. And the Short Troopers, again, that's another one. I built a Short Trooper costume, for my eldest son. And like the helmet design for that is just beautiful too. And I kind of thought, wow, because it's in world, it's something we've never seen before. It's meticulously like detailed. And I just love, you can see the progression, the evolution of the helmet designs from, you know, the phase one clone troopers all the way up to the Sith troopers from Rise of Skywalker. Mm-hmm. So there's that evolution, which I really love when it's in place there. So that's the first and foremost, if it gets my attention, and I kind of go, ooh, I want to build that. That's the first thing. Mm. Then I'll look into it. And then, you know, in Star Wars, there are body types that suit certain outfits. You know, it's like anything else, it's all about angles sometimes. You can put on armor and look like, wow, he just stepped off the screen. And then you move the camera over and then my stomach protrudes. And you see the armor splitting a bit. And you kind of go, nah, fat stormtrooper. And so there's that consideration as well for me, because it's like, I want to look good in the armor too. The armor itself is great, because in 1977, they had dancers and thin British guys basically dressed up in that armor. And it looks great because they were sticks. And you could hang the armor, which is bulky, on them and make them look like regular sized human beings. But if you have like a regular and average, whatever that means, shaped person, and then you put armor on them, they get bulky. It bulks them up. So you have to have a certain physique to really, really pull off that outfit. I don't. I can cheat a bit. I can suck in my gut. I can put on the Spanx or whatever, and be really uncomfortable for a bit. And a shout out to all the ladies who do that, and all the gentlemen who put on like shape forming wear. Mm-hmm. I get it. It's like, yeah, it cuts off blood circulation. It's not cool. And you're doing that for like 3 millimeters of space, but damn, that 3 millimeters stops totally the armor from popping off the side. Yeah. So there's that as well. And with the Vader, it's, you know, like me deciding that, like I put on the helmet, it's just heavy. Mm. It's, you realize that it's a strain on your shoulders and on your neck. And if you're wearing that for more than an hour, you're going to have a lot of issues with your body. And it's hot. You have fans and you have different ways of cooling your body down, but I sweat in the shower. So it's one of these things where I need to be hydrated. I need to, you know, it's one of these 3D processes where I have to like consume so much water beforehand and retain it all, so that when I go out and troop, I'll sweat it all out and my body will maintain its equilibrium. Mm. So there's that involved too. But I think one of the things about cosplaying is, for me at least, is that aesthetic is, I want to look good. I want to feel good in the armor too. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm self-conscious enough that, you know, if they kind of go, ooh, fat stormtrooper, you know, it doesn't make it fun for me anymore. So
yeah, sure.
You know, that's the thing. We all have our own issues about body. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. Like, I look at myself and go, yeah, I'm fat. And their dance is like, yeah, fat stormtrooper's coming and going to take your cookies. Right? So you better watch out. And I love people who just, they don't care. They're like, I love this costume. I'm going to wear it. I don't care what you think. And I think that's amazing. And I want to get to that point too. But for me now, it's all about the details in terms of, will it look like I stepped off the screen? Mm. And that's where I come from in terms of my cosplay. I want to be able to look like, holy shit, he was in, you know, he just got out of his X-wing, or he just got out of his TIE fighter, his TIE fighter. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. I feel you. I think Porkins was created just for me. Right. That's the only thing I could ever really convince someone of being.
Well, I mean, and then they named him Porkins.
Yeah, well,
like they literally named him Porkins. It's like, really? Come on, George.
And then you know, William Hootkins is like a really like accomplished, like respected actor, and there he is at like a 5 second role playing like Porkins. It's just, it feels a little beneath him, but you know, whatever. It's a legendary role. You know, we're never gonna forget him.
There was no such thing as fat shaming in 1977. You know,
that's true. I guess
it was on for everyone.
Yeah, and then Red 5 was like, wow, the first Asian sort of other than Rose Tico shown is like, Red 5, where are you going? And this is a pudgy Chinese pilot who's going, I'm, you know, like, I need help. And it's like, well, we know you're dead. Because Luke has your call sign. So it's like, yes, and the Asian pilot gets, you know, thrown off course. And I kind of go, oh, okay, okay.
Well, I was going to ask about that because, you know, if you look at sort of the history of Star Wars, I mean, obviously, you know, for George Lucas, like Akira Kurosawa films and just like the history of like Japanese culture, you know, samurai culture, Japanese history was all, you know, there's a huge influences on Star Wars and the genesis of Star Wars. But then when you actually look at, you know, the films themselves, especially, you know, the original trilogy, like that's a very white series of films. And even in the new films, there's not, you know, Rose Tico obviously is a trailblazer in that sense, but there's not a lot of Asian representation in the films at this point still. I mean, is that something that, you know, you'd really like to see them like address as a priority?
Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, it's funny when the alien species out are your diversity, you know, and it's just like when you have the non-masked characters and they're predominantly white, you know, you kind of go, okay. In the 70s, I get it because there weren't that many, you know, actors of color really around. And they shot it primarily in Britain, right? So all these pilots, especially in A New Hope, I mean, the big joke is all the pilots were all British, putting on American accents. And, you know, you kind of go, well, you know, it's representation is a really powerful thing. And when you see somebody who looks like you up on the screen, it's life altering. It really is. It makes a big difference. And I grew up not seeing a lot of people who looked like me on screen, unless they were the bad guys, unless they were the joke. They were always the other, but never the hero, maybe the sidekick, but always the sidekick you could laugh at and not take seriously. And that has an effect on your psyche, especially when you're a kid. So it would be lovely for Star Wars, and I think they're taking steps towards that. They are. I mean, I don't think they actually are. Not at the pace that we'd all like, obviously, but it's a start, and it's moving in that direction. I mean, you look at Mandalorian, and Ming-Na Wen is in it, which is great. I killed her, but I mean, she was on there, right? She was badass.
I was sure she was going to come back at some point, but it looks like she's really dead.
I don't know. They keep so many things open.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a weird thing. It's like, I still think it's not, I mean, unless you see her bones, right? Like if that, and who are the boots? Who goes and stumbles across that body? Like, who is that? And what's, and why have that? If, you know, so I don't know.
If you're not going to bring it, yeah.
I'm sort of hedging my bets there, kind of going, man, maybe it's not the last. Because she's a big name too, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure.
So you kind of go, would you just use her for just that one? So that, yeah, that,
you've got to look at Darth Maul. Chopped in half, still came back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, once he can come back, that's, you know, and you can bring Ming-Na Wen back and just pull a, you know, cloning, dark science, secrets only Ming-Na Wen knew, you know.
It's twin sister. I mean, I would love to see more representation. And I think with the introduction of Rose Tico, I love that. I loved seeing her. And I love Kelly Michelle Tran's, like her reaction to being part included in that universe. She would, she reacted exactly how I would. She was so happy and so thankful and like out with the fans and having a great time. And then the trolls took over after people didn't like the movie, and like the backlash and the amount of hatred she received online was shameful, absolutely shameful. It's systemic racism. It's the worst part of fandom, these butthurt fanboys who are crying and screaming because how dare they introduce a woman as a main character and an Asian woman at that. And it's disgusting. That's not fandom. That is honest. That's like white supremacy. That is like absolute... It goes absolutely against what Star Wars and I think sci-fi fandom stands for. It's about acceptance, inclusivity. It is about, you know, exploring strange, not strange, but great new ideas. Almost went to the Star Trek the Star Trek opening. But it is. And so the fact, and one of the biggest beefs as well that I have with The Rise of Skywalker is they literally take a character that would could have done something great with Rose and they make her stay behind to study.
Mm.
They make the Asian, like, think about that and what that says. Mm. They make the Asian character stay behind and not join the adventure to fucking study.
Mm.
I lost it. Yeah. Lost my fucking mind, because what a waste of a character. But they'll introduce five or six different fucking characters that you barely know about. But hey, like the Carrie Russell character, she's a fantastic actor. I love her. But it's like you're introducing this character who wears a helmet for 90% of the movie.
Yeah.
And you're fine with that. But you don't like Rose.
Mm.
I have an issue. I have issues with that. And she's great. And maybe they'll spin off her character to something else. They're building up something for the characters. Fine.
Hope so.
But the fact that you take an established character and you bow to the will of a bunch of white supremacist, angry fans drives me nuts. I think it's a lost opportunity. And when you start caving in and catering to a hateful group of fans, you're never going to be successful. I mean, that's integrity in storytelling and care and love for your characters means you take a stand. It's especially against stuff like that. Mm. Sorry, I get off my soapbox because that drove me nuts.
No, about bravo. That, you know, I could not agree more.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of her work, though. Like, I love her attitude. I think she's a fantastic actor. She's up there on the wall of fame. Yeah. You know, like, we love her. I got her you know, Funko Pop, Rose Tico. And I was really looking forward to seeing what they were going to do with her in Rise of Skywalker. And I was bitterly disappointed in that. So that's my two cents.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, if you go, you mentioned, you know, going back to the 70s and, you know, that Toshiro Mifune's daughter has talked about the fact that, like, he was offered the role of, well, I think it's been known for a long time that he was offered the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi. And according to his daughter, he was also offered the role of Darth Vader. And it's just crazy to think about, like, how much that would have changed, you know, like, the films, I guess, but also just what that would have meant for representation to have, like, someone like Toshiro Mifune play such a, you know, major role in the story from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because, yeah, Lucas was such a big fan of his work. You know, but I think with Toshiro Mifune, I think one of the things that he might have, I mean, because when Star Wars came out, it was nobody, I mean, Al Guinness hated it. He hated being on it, right?
Yeah.
Like, he was just like, what is this? This is drivel. And he wrote this letter to his friend, that famous letter that he wrote to his friend. It was like, this is abominable and stuff. And so you look at it at the time, I mean, Star Wars is Star Wars now, but back then it was just like, what is this?
Mm.
You want me to do what? You want me to be in a desert in Tunisia? Right. And, you know, I'm wondering if Mifune, if you read the script and went, well, that sounds like all the movies that I made before.
Mm. And exactly. Yeah. Why would I do,
like,
that again?
Why would I do this again? It's just like I'm being really typecast, right?
Yeah.
And so I could understand him kind of like taking a pass on it. And, you know, it's in another language.
Mm.
Which is, it's got its challenges as well. It's funny, I was just rewatching the original version of Midway on Blu-ray because they had the remake of it, or Roland Emmerich's version. And I was like, okay, I want to watch the original with the big sort of all-star cast. And Toshiro Mifune, like the whole Japanese fleet is there, is an all-star cast of Asian-American actors at the time and Japanese performers. And Toshiro Mifune is there as Admiral Yamamoto.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can tell they dubbed over all of his dialogue.
Mm.
And so he was probably speaking it, but they had to dub over it again and re-record his dialogue. So I'm wondering if that was
a factor,
something in his decision not to do it as well. It's like if I had to do a movie in French, I speak a little bit of French. Give me time. I'll try it. Right. And I'll do my best, but it's like, I don't know, especially, you know, and so nobody knew that Star Wars was going to be like that because the original title was very unwieldy too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Luke Scar, Starkiller.
Starkiller
and the Wills.
Yeah, the General of the Wills.
Exactly. You're like, oh. Okay. What else has Lucas done before? Oh. Okay. All right. Let's move. You know, hindsight is 20/20.
Exactly.
But I get it. Like I kind of go, you know, the choices actors make. Sometimes they look back and go, shit. Should have taken it.
For your journey to becoming an actor, like how much of a role did Star Wars and your fandom of sci-fi in general play in that? Like when you were a kid, was it watching that kind of stuff that made you want to become an actor in the first place?
When I was a kid, I didn't even know I could be an actor. That wasn't even a possibility for me. I learned how to speak English by watching television. My parents immigrated to Canada when I was 3 months old. They didn't speak any English. They were both teachers in Korea, but because they didn't speak the language, they had to take menial jobs, like just basically Joe jobs to make money, because they couldn't be professionals there. And so they were constantly working. And back then, you could leave your kids alone and not have a babysitter. Or at least I think you could. My parents did. And so... The television was my babysitter, and it was an incredible escape for me. The stories that I watched, and I loved, you know, the big shows that I watched other than Looney Tunes and the cartoons were Space 1999 and Star Trek. Those are the two big must see. And then there was Lost in Space and Gilligan's Island and the Andy Griffith Show and all these things. But the big shows I could not miss were Star Trek and Space 1999. And so I grew up loving sci-fi and all this stuff. And then when Star Wars came out, my dad took us to see it in the movies. He only took us to see it once because you didn't watch a movie more than once. You already saw it. Why would I waste money doing that? So
he sounds a little bit like Mr. Kim. Like, is there a little bit of...
He's just very pragmatic.
Yeah.
He's very, very, yes. And so we were... Growing up, TV had always been an escape. Movies had, I'm a big fan, never thought in a million years that I could be an actor. Didn't even consider, wasn't even like, oh, maybe I could be an actor. Didn't even think about that. Not once. And then, you know, growing up with Asian parents, immigrant parents, who basically sacrificed everything to give you opportunities, the pressure's there to succeed and, you know, be successful and be a professional who makes lots of money so you never have to go through what your parents went through. So my parents always said you could be four things, doctor, lawyer, engineer, or a failure. Okay, I guess I'll try. Wow. And so they actually went so far as to move out of the school district, the feeder high school I was supposed to go to. They moved into another high school district so I could go to that high school, another high school, which had an enriched academic program called the International Baccalaureate, or IB. And so they enrolled me in that. And it's advanced studies. And it sucks because it's so hard. And I was away from all of my friends that I'd sort of gone to school with from elementary school all the way through junior high in a new school with really hard subjects. And by that point, I'd lost all interest in science and math and anything. I was just done. Was not registering with me, was not enjoying it. But what happened was in the International Baccalaureate program for the humanities, it was wonderful. Because there were so many different opportunities. You didn't have to just write a boring essay or do this or that. You could, but they opened it up in terms of presentations. We had a VCR, and back at the time, the VCR came with this camera, a video camera that you had to attach to half the VCR and carry the VCR around if you wanted to use a camera. And so we made video presentations, which for me was like, oh my God, we can videotape this. And I don't have to write anything down and we can put it on VHS and we'll edit it from VHS to VHS, which is so labor intensive and it looks so garbagey because you have the lines in between every cut. You can see every cut. But it was just so that it blew my mind to be able to express myself that way in terms of storytelling. And I realized I really loved writing and storytelling and this and that. And you know, so that blew up in my parents' face because that's where I really found this love for storytelling. I realized I've been consuming them for so long and I had them all in my head and I related so hard with a lot of characters, especially if they're the outsiders looking in. Characters like Mr. Spock really spoke to me because he wanted to fit in. Well, I mean, you know, he was of another world and caught in between. And that was me exactly, you know, too Korean looking to be considered Canadian, too Canadian to be considered fully Korean. Where do you fit in? And so that really spoke to me. And realizing that you want to tell stories is very empowering too. When you figure out what you kind of want to do, that's really cool. And I got a scholarship that paid for my first year university. And I went to U of T, mostly because my girlfriend was going there and I wanted to get away from my parents. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we did that. I went there and then I had to pick courses and I was going to be a writer. And I was going to go into fine arts, actually. I wanted to be a cartoonist at one point. And I saw the drama program. And I thought, hey, you know, in English, we did a couple of presentations. We wrote some sketches. And it was fun performing them. And I signed up to audition for the drama program. And that's a whole other story in of itself. But I got in and really fell in love with the craft of acting. And for the first time in my life, it suddenly occurred to me that maybe I could be in those stories too. I could be an actor. Mm. Yeah. And that was really, really life-changing and exciting because I felt like I had a purpose. I had something that I want, a focused goal that I really wanted to pursue through and through. And the fool that I was had my head in the clouds and I'm going to be the star of all these TV shows and movies and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. It's the youthful exuberance of being in school. And then when I graduated from school, I suddenly realized I have no idea how to get a job as an actor. So, you know, that began the sort of journey into, you know, being an actor. And I've always said I was too stupid and too stubborn to quit, which is why I'm still here. And I've had a lot of great fortune along the way, met a lot of fantastic artists. A lot of people supported me and taken me under their wings and given me advice, which is why as well, I feel it is my duty to give back to younger actors, to anybody who needs that kind of help or advice to guide them along the way. And which is why representation and inclusivity is a platform that I will speak for till my end. Because it's discouraging enough to be an actor, but when you're an actor and you're limited to the types of roles you're allowed to play, or, you know, you're told that your story doesn't matter, it's wrong. That's wrong. And I went through that and I don't want the next generation to go through that. So we pay it forward by helping those behind who are beginning in their journey and build them up as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, speaking of the types of role that you want to play, let's say, you know, dream scenario, you could play like any type of character in Star Wars. I mean, do you see yourself as more of an Imperial type? Do you see yourself as a rebel? Are you the badass bounty hunter type? Like where would you see yourself like fitting in ideally?
Honestly, I would love to play a bad guy.
Mm.
I don't. It's funny, you know, Appa is very gentle and very, but the bad guys have the most fun, I think. They really do. And the bad guys don't do it to be evil. I think the best bad guys, the best villains, they're the ones that believe what they're doing is for everybody's good.
Yeah.
They really believe in that. Like, you don't become arch and like, I'm going to do, you know, it's not that. It really is, you know. I'm going to bring peace to the universe, to the galaxy. Yeah. And we need to do this. And this is, and that's scary because then they're true believers. They're not, it's not some sort of a power struggle. It is literally, it's ideology. And so that's always kind of fun. And you know, the Imperials have the cooler stuff. It's cool. bounty hunters are God, I would want to play all of them. Bounty hunter, bad guy who turns into a good guy. It's to play the bad guy. Just I go off on tangents. I'm so sorry.
No, go for it.
I just go everywhere. I'm like a balloon. You let the air out. I'm like, oh fuck, is he gonna stop talking? I love just being able to play characters that I'm not, you know? I love Uppa. He's not me. I'm not Uppa. And that's what's so much fun about playing him. He's somebody I know. He's that's my dad's voice. That's my mom's temper. That's my grandfather, my uncles, all these stubborn Korean men I grew up. That's them. I'm slowly becoming that as I get older, but it's not me right now, right? And so that's the joy of playing being an actor is playing parts that you wouldn't be. Andrea Bang, who plays Janet on the show, she is so not like Janet. She is, she's got the hoodie up with the drawstring clothes. She likes anonymity, but she's an artist. She does work that engages her. And so her work as Janet is spectacular because that is so not her. But people think that's exactly Andrea. It's not. And for an actor, that's the biggest compliment when people think you're actually like that character. So if you're playing a baddie on TV and people hate you in real life, it sucks. And you kind of go, come on, guys. But it means you're doing a great job. And Giancarlo Esposito, for example, like him as Moff Gideon, is you look at him and you go, oh, and he's a sweetheart in real life. You know he's a sweetheart. And, you know, for him to play somebody that freaking evil, in a sense, you kind of go, ooh, that's, I love that. Love seeing that. I always wanted to see, and I always said this, I always wanted to see Robin Williams play a bad guy. Like a really scary sort
of villain. Well, did you ever see a 1 hour photo?
Yes. That's
yeah.
And it's really, it's jarring.
It's disturbing, right? Cause it's like, whoa, who is this guy?
Yeah. And you never look at them the same way again. But I think it's for me, being an actor is about craft. It's what you bring to the table and being able to, you know, embody these characters. Gary Oldman is one of my favorite actors just because he does that. You know, they always say, oh, he's a chameleon. He's crafted is what he is. He's crafted and he plays these characters. And that's something to aim for. Like, I love seeing that when they disappear. And then, you know, you don't – like, Tom Cruise is a good actor, but Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise in everything.
Oh, yeah.
Even though he's doing it, it's like – I don't, yes, I know you're Ethan Hunt, but it's really Tom Cruise. And I'm cool with that because you're good. And I love that. But it's that whole, when you become too big and people just see the actor instead of the role and you want to be sublime and get past that. Brad Pitt, same thing. They're so famous now. People just see it as Brad Pitt in a tank.
Well, it's that distinction between, you know, a movie star and an actor and, you know, why the guys who are both are so rare.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I see that your screen wife in Kim's Convenience, Jin Yoon, had a little role in The Expanse season one. She got to play that kind of badass Starship Commander, didn't she? Did you talk about
that? Yes, she did. She did. I'm so jealous. And she kills it. Jeannie, I love her so much. And she gets to do so many of the things that I really want to do. She's been in a number of sci-fi shows, which kills me because I don't know if she really likes that genre, but she works it. I'm like, fuck, come on, man. Put me in, coach. But she, Captain Yao, she still gets stopped on the streets from Expanse fans. And that's like The Expanse season one. And people like Kim's what? No. The Expanse, Captain Yao, fucking, you know, like you sacrificed your ship. You did, you know, and I love Jeannie because, because she's an awesome human being, first of all. She's one of the actors at the beginning who really, really took me under her wing and helped me out. That's Jean. She's a connector. She's a networker. She helps people. That's where she finds her joy. And so Jean, what she does is brings an incredible level of craft to the roles as well. So her playing it, like, you buy it. You buy that she's a captain of a gigantic starship because she has that built-in sort of authority that she can – she's diminutive. She's going to hate me for saying this, but she points it out. She's short. She's a short woman. And she always jokes that if she was 2 feet taller, she'd be a superstar, and I totally believe her in that. but it is she's short, but she has so much presence and so much power. And she commands that. She demands it as well in terms of people's attention. Like, she knows how to fill a space without having to say anything. That's the type of actor she is. And so, we got a chance to work together on Dark Matter.
I just watched that last night.
And it was so much fun because according to Joe Mazzoli, the producer of Dark Matter, we had both auditioned for the role, and I thought, well, we got to cast them both together. And so we went on, and it was hilarious because it was up on Oma in space. And we did a take. There was a joke take where we did it in our Kim's Convenience character, which was great. And then there was one point where, because spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen it, she kills me in that episode. She disagrees with our course of action, and she ends up stabbing me in the neck with a sharp object. And I remember they were setting up the shot for her, you know, looking very menacingly at me and advancing on me.
Mm.
And I saw her reflection, and I stopped and I turned around, and she had the thing. I said, "Yeah, what are you doing?" Right? it was the best. So getting a chance to work, and that was like, I think the first sci-fi show I'd ever been cast in as a sci-fi character. I'm struggling. It's like, no, that's the
well, you were in RoboCop, the remake of RoboCop.
Yeah, as a you know, in a deleted scene.
Oh yeah,
which was and that was a treat as well, and that was really cool to shoot because I was an Omnitech core technician, and I was basically running this huge. I was running the link between the press the tactical unit that was in Baghdad and the Pentagon. And we had this great sort of hollow emitter, and I was pretending to see where the units were. A lot of military babble, you know, give me the go, no go for insertion. And it was this huge crane shot in this gigantic studio with two-story tall green screens and dozens of LEDs to make it look like the Pentagon war room. And it was supposed to be a big sweeping shot of the crane over me as I'm talking to this unit. And it goes up to a general who's getting interviewed, getting ready for an interview on CNN. And I remember walking out to set, and there are hundreds of background performers. They're all dressed like me, but they're all looking at you because why does he have a makeup and hair person with them? Why is he being escorted? Oh, he has lines. I'm like, yeah, I got lines. So we went up, and it was great because I'm playing and there's nothing in front of me, but I'm pretending I'm typing on a touchpad, and I'm seeing things, and I'm doing the techno babble speak. And it was like six lines. It was awesome. So they set up the shot, and it's a big sweeping shot. We go, and I'm nervous because I don't fuck it up. Because if you screw it up, you cut, reset, and everybody's got to start from the beginning, and the 100 extras kind of go, he's an asshole. So we go, and we do the pass, and go, that was great. That was amazing. We need you to speak more, though. So we're going to give you more dialogue to cover the sweep over. I'm like, okay. So they start making shit up on the spot and adding to it. And none of it's really making sense. But I'm like, okay. And I'm just, and we do another page. That's great. We're going to give you more lines. We're going to give you more and more and more. And by the end, I was like, I had this huge, it felt like a huge monologue talking to this team. Went over and they said, that's great. You're done. And it was 2 hours and it was awesome. And the movie came out and I was like, I'm going to watch it. And they cut my scene. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. They just started with the general. And I kind of went, well, yeah, that makes sense. Because what I was doing didn't serve the story other than to establish that I'm talking to them. But what I was saying to them made no sense anyway. So that's the business, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, you mentioned that type of actor who disappears into, you know, into a role. Like that was sort of my experience of like watching, you know, so I've only sort of really discovered your work these last few months, because so Kim's Convenience is on, it's on Netflix over here in Australia, so it's not like a sort of like a network show that's being promoted really heavily all the time. Like it's a kind of thing you sort of have to discover through like word of mouth and that kind of thing. So we threw on the first episode, and then my girlfriend and I just got like addicted to it. Like we watched like the first three seasons in about like 2 weeks. Horribly mistimed it, because this was just before the corona thing. What we should have done was like waited and binged on it if we'd known. Right. And then season 4 dropped on Netflix a couple of weeks ago, and now we're like rationing it like it's that last roll of toilet paper, you know, in the corona apocalypse. We're like, don't, you got to save a few episodes for, you know. So But then coming across your unboxing videos on YouTube, like because I was really only sort of familiar with your work. I mean, I'd probably seen you in other things, but like as you know, as a sort of lead actor through through Kim's Convenience, seeing those YouTube videos, I was like, oh my God, like who is this? This is not the guy that I just watched three seasons worth of in Kim's Convenience. Like it's just, and you know, anyone who knows that show and has now, you know, listened to this interview thus far, you know, has probably had a similar experience, but it's really fun to watch those videos and I guess see like the real you and see like that other, you know, that other side of you. I mean, was that something that came about through just sheer isolation, boredom? Was it something you were thinking about doing anyway? What was the genesis of those videos?
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, it was a little bit of both. I'd always sort of entertained the idea of doing a YouTube video, but I never had the opportunity, the time, or really the impulse to actually get to it. Mm-hmm. Like podcasting. Like I've got all this great, these great, like I bought these mics and I've got, you know, all these things set up. I'm going to do a podcast. And they literally sat, like the pandemic happened and I cracked all this gear out. I finally get a chance to use it. And so, yeah, that's how the video sort of started. I was bored and I was seeing that online. A lot of people were very anxious, which is fair. And they were looking for some sort of distraction or a bit of entertainment. And so it was twofold for me. One was I thought the Skywalker saga had just been released in 4K. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to have had the foresight to pre-order the box set before it sold out. Mm-hmm. And so it came in the mail and I thought, oh my God. And a friend of mine said, you should do an unboxing video because there are a lot of people who are on the fence as to whether they want to purchase this thing or not. Mm. And you could help them. And I thought, oh, yeah, I could do that. So I set up my phone and I you know, I was at my kitchen table upstairs doing it. And you see my wife walk by at one point to get her shoes. And so it's as amateur as you can get. But I think with a lot of stuff that I try to do when it's just me, I really try not to put on too many airs, so to speak. It's just, I just want to stay true to who I am. This is who I am. I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm a fan, like a lot of people. And I think you can connect more with people when you're normal, like when you're not, like I'm in my palace or I'm in my hot tub surrounded by rose petals saying, pandemic's not bad. It's none of that. It's just like, hey man, I'm stuck at home and I'm bored too, but this came in the mail and this is really cool. I want to share this with you. And that's it. It's just honest and plain and simple. And so that's how it came about. And then I was really nervous posting it because I thought I'm not as polished as a lot of these, like these YouTubers that my kids watch. They've got, you know, all the bells and whistles, great introductions. And my son's saying, you know, when you hit 1 million subscribers, they give you a gold thingy or whatever. I'm like, I said, yeah, okay. I'll be happy if I get like 10. You know, and it's like, I'm not doing this for subscribers, but for them, that's what it's all about, right? It's how many subscribers, how many likes, how many ads can you get on it and this and that, how many views, how many clicks. And I was just like, I just want to do this to sort of distract people and show them, hey, here's, if you're thinking about getting the set, this is what's inside of it. And this is what I think about it. That's it. It was a distraction for me. It was also learning a new skill. And I found out that I really kind of enjoyed it. Once the positive feedback came in, I thought, I can do better. I can make these a little bit more streamlined. I can edit them better. I can add a little bit of production value. And each of those steps takes time for me to learn. So I'm investing time in it as well. And I love that because it's keeping me busy. And I get to sort of do all these things where I'm kind of performing by being in front of the camera, but I'm also editing things and I'm learning new skills. And it's been really, really cool. And I'm connecting with people, which is great. People are liking the videos and they want to see more. So that as somebody who's posting any sort of content online, it's a lovely thing to hear. And so I want to keep doing that. And when the pandemic is over, I want to keep doing it too. I still want to continue on and reaching out and just connecting with people.
One of the highlights of the videos is seeing, obviously, you know, especially from the second video on, when you're in your self-described geeky basement and you can see all your collectibles surrounding you. I mean, this might be like trying to pick a favorite child, but do you have like a favorite collectible? Like, is there one thing that you've sort of picked up over the years that means the most to you?
Well, you know what? It's got to be the Proton Pack, because it just spent so much time and energy sourcing it and researching it. And the attention to detail that I put into it was a little unhealthy, to be honest. And there was a point where it's like, I have to stop. I have to just let this go and it's not at the right angle, but just let it go. I mean, there's... You see the minutiae of detail that people have gone into to recreate the Spengler pack or the Stans pack. That's right. Each of the Proton packs, the hero versions, have their own variations, and people have done meticulous recreations right down to the scratches in the faux wood on the side. It's incredible. So that's got to be my big standout piece. That's the game. That's the showstopper right there. When I truck that out, people lose their minds. But it's funny, because these things that I collect, again, it's like the Star Wars costumes. I always look at them and kind of go, that's so cool. I want that. I want to have something like that. And I want to be able to, I play with my stuff. Like I play with my,
yeah,
it's out of the box. I got to, you can't just keep it in a box forever. Right.
Absolutely.
And they're meant, I still believe collectibles are meant to be shown. And it's funny, because they say, well, I keep it in the box for resale value. It's like, are you really going to resell this stuff?
Yeah.
I look at that and I kind of go, that's how I justify buying it in the first place. It's got incredible high resale value. It'll be like, yeah. So I'll buy it. And it's like, I'm never letting this go. Yeah. Fuck you, box. And I open it up and I'll put it out.
I'm going to drop my virtual background in there. I take everything out of the box as well.
Yes, as it should be.
Yeah.
Now, do you keep the boxes though, Baz?
No, I don't have the space for that. And I did at one point when I was, I lived in Glasgow for a while, and I kept a lot of the boxes from then. And then when I moved, I got rid of them. And I just decided I don't keep them anymore, because, you know, if you box something up again, it's not worth as much. Anyway, and a lot of people keep theirs in the box now anyway, so that kind of diminishes the worth of what everybody has.
So once you've broken the seal,
like in the 70s, few people didn't take their toys out of the box, so that means that the ones in boxes are worth so much more than now, when everyone keeps them in the box, the value's there. But the value to me is really just standing them up in groups on shelves and looking at them, you know.
Yep, absolutely. You're speaking right to my heart too. I feel exactly the same way. I'm just starting to throw away box. I still would keep the boxes, and it's like you say, there's no room for it. It's like, are you ever going to put it back in the box? Well, when are you going to move? Well, how often do you move? And I'm not going to resell them. So it's like, but the packaging is pretty sometimes, right? Because it's like, yeah, but you know what? The real prize really is not the packaging, unless you're a cat or a small child. It's what's inside, right? And so that's like you're saying, that's why it's I've started to sort of call the box collection. There's stuff that is like wow.
I'll tell a lie, I have kept a couple of recent boxes from like the Rogue One tank and the Desert Skiff, like the vintage collection boxes, because they're so beautiful and they do evoke the old 70s and 80s boxes that Kenner used to put out in the early days. So
How important is like the sentimental value of like a collectible to you? Like for me, like I'm not huge into the collectibles. Like I'm more into kind of like, you know, I buy all like the behind the scenes books and stuff like that. But you know, one of the, it's like a collectible that means a lot to me is like, I've got like the samurai Darth Vader. And that means something to me, cause like I got it in Tokyo and it's like, oh sweet. It's like a memory of that trip. And it's like really relevant to that whole, you know, that time or whatever. Like how important is that to you? Like, do you sort of have particular memories that you associate with a lot of your collectibles?
A few of them. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, the Hasbro Infinity Gauntlet is one just because my connection with that movie was with my boys. What I do is I pull them from school the day a movie premieres, and we go out and we catch a matinee before it gets super crazy. And so I did that with the Avengers, and it was with both my boys for the first, one of the first times.
What age are your boys, Paul?
So my eldest is turning 16 in May. My youngest is 10. So it was like the first time I pulled them both from school and just sort of, we went and we watched the movie. So that movie has a sentimental, just in terms of my timeline. Mm-hmm. And then the Infinity Gauntlet was, I was at a con and they had just come out and I was searching for them, but they were all grossly overpriced. Really, really hard to find. And I was looking at them going, I want to support these small stores, but you guys are just gouging now. And so I can't, in good conscience, drop that kind of money on something that is literally hundreds of dollars less. And I get it, because I know vendors have to, especially if they're going across country, they have huge shipping costs to pay, right? Transport and this and that. But it's just like, that's too big of a margin. I couldn't do that. And then I was able to finally on the last day track it down, and it was at a decent price and the vendor was really awesome. And so I was more than happy to pay for that. And so I got it and I came out and then I showed it to the boys and they lost their minds. And the first thing they did, like everybody does, is they gave everybody the finger with the Infinity Gauntlet. It's like, it's not like you want to sort of snap, and everybody I saw doing it, they first thing they do is they flip the bird. And I love it because it's a great sociological experiment that I do now. It's when I show it to people and say, yeah, try it on. Ooh, it lights up. The first thing they do, I want to say, what is the first thing they do? And nobody tries to snap their fingers. That's second. It's always giving the finger first. So just for shits and giggles, that's why I, you know, that one I had to hunt down for, which I like. And same with there's a metal K2SO that I have from the Disney store, actually. And it was rare to get, because a lot of people wouldn't go to the Disney store for the Star Wars stuff. Mm. They would go for Toy Story or Cars or any of the other franchises, but nobody really thought of Star Wars and Disney because they just recently sort of procured that. So I think a lot of collectors went out and just scooped up all the die-cast metal figures that they had. And so it was hard to find that one. And I was lucky enough to grab, to track one down finally and get one.
Yeah.
So it's the stuff that's a little bit obscure and harder to get that it's part of, it's the thrill of the hunt for me. Mm. I also just like having stuff.
Don't we all? Don't we all?
Pretty much everything is obscure and difficult to get in Australia if you're talking about Star Wars merchandise. So, right. I found that to my cost, but persevere.
There are a tremendous group of craftspeople in Australia, though. A lot of these builds for the costumes, they're Australian, and they're fabricating them and they're selling them around the world. But I like, there's a number of different people on the Facebook groups who I sourced the buckles for my Mud Trooper helmet, the slide buckles and the clasps. Mm-hmm. They're screen accurate from what's his name? Is it Darren Vaughn in Australia? And he was like, he's the go-to guy because he was able to source and find these parts and they weren't available anywhere else. So everybody who's going and asking this guy in Australia to like, I need 4 slide clips and 2 buckles. Do you have the respirator mask clips? You have all these little things that are impossible to find anywhere else. This fellow in Australia had.
It's nice that door swings both ways then. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is there a particular, I know in one of your videos, you talked about like how much you enjoy the Innovos helmets. Like, are there particular like brands where, you know, if they put something out, like if they put a Star Wars collectible out, you're just like, I got to have it? Or is it really like an item by item thing for you?
It all depends. I mean, certain ones stand out more than others. Sideshow Collectibles, for example. It depends on what they're releasing, because Sideshow has always been like top notch, but really super expensive for the majority of things. But I dropped heavy cash on the pre-order for the child, the Mandalorian 1-to-1 ratio child. I was actually able to hold the real version of it when I was on set with the Mandalorian. And oh my God, it's, I mean, it's, I think it's Legacy. They're the ones that created it. And it's the real one is silicone. And you see the little fine hairs in the costume that's you know, sewn together, and the little details like the frayed hole with the foot pops out at the bottom. And no one sees that, but it's there. And I love that. And so it was really, I saw that for Sideshow Collect. They were offering the pre-order, and I dropped like $400 on it. I was like, this is stupid. But I want it because it's so, because I held the real thing and it's weighted. Well, the one on set was weighted, so it felt like you were holding a baby and you jiggle it a little bit in the years we go. And oh, so the gosh. Sideshow collectible one looked, at least the picture they had, looked just like that. And it's from Legacy as well. So I thought, you know what? This is something that is really special because I don't know. It just captured my imagination. Mm. And it's, I was like, I want that.
It sounds like your next build is going to have to be the Mando, then, so you can really.
Oh no! Again, the Fat Mandalorian. Maybe the heavy, like the big bulky guys, like the heavy Mando.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The one,
Favreau's one, or the one Favreau voiced. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. That'd be really cool. But then he's got all the heavy, like it's a heavy costume, right? Because he's got the big gun and the jetpack and stuff like that. But again, I take into account body shape too, especially if you. Playing a canon character, it's more difficult for me to play Han Solo because I won't shave my beard and I'm Asian and I'm like 100 pounds heavier than Harrison Ford. So it's like,
Want to have to explain who you're dressed as. That's not good.
Yeah. It's like Asian Han Solo. It's like, okay. So I don't play a lot of face characters. I mean, there was a time that I thought, I could pull off a Baze Malbus.
I could
do him, like put a wig on because I got the beard. I could put on the armor. You can move around in it and stuff. And so that's another costume that's on the back burner right now in terms of what I'd like to wear and build. So far, I've been working. My son pointed out too. He said, "Hey, Dad, you look like Fat Thor from Endgame." I'm like, because I had my shirt off and I had my I just gotten out of the shower and was getting changed and I had my sweats on and I had a shirtless and I've got the beard. I said, "All you need is the hair." I'm like, and I looked at my body and went, "I do look like Fat Thor. I could play Asian Fat Thor, like Asian dad bod Thor."
Well, right? the great thing about a Fat Thor costume is it kind of doubles as a Big Lebowski costume. So it's like, you can't go wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, with the Infinity Gauntlet, like.
Yeah. So, Sideshow is good. And then Novos. If there, Novos, I know. Everybody who heard me say that and cringed and went, fucking Novos. For those who don't know, they got the official license for Star Wars and for Star Trek too, and Battlestar Galactica and some Marvel stuff. But what happened was they stopped shipping stuff in a timely manner. And they took, it was like this reverse Ponzi, like a Ponzi scheme, because they were literally taking at one point money from pre-orders that were supposed to be delivered in months or weeks. And they used it to prop up where they had cash shortfalls because they originally a lot of the stuff that they created was being produced in China, manufactured. Mm-hmm. And when they got the samples back, they weren't happy with the quality of the work or the detail to it. So there's this big back and forth between them. And that led to a lot of cost overruns and a lot of delays. And they started running out of money. And instead of being smart and just being upfront and saying, "We're not going to do any more pre-orders. We're going to stop. We're going to focus on this. And once that's fixed, we're going to keep going." They kept taking money for pre-orders, which was their biggest mistake, to try to shore up everything. And so a lot of people were mad because they were literally waiting for 3 years for this stuff to arrive. I just saw on a thread today, somebody ordered first order TK armor from a Novos, beautiful kit, in 2016. And they still haven't received it yet.
Oh, wow.
And it's hard, especially when a Nova sends you a blast email saying, "Hey, we've got this new Star Trek stuff. Or how about a pre-order for more Mandalorian stuff? It's available in stock." You kind of go, "Well, what about my stuff? I paid for this years ago in good faith. And the customer service wasn't the best." But the thing about a Novos is when you do get their material, it's incredible. It's great, good quality. And I have to say, I was bashing them for a while because I thought they've taken my money. and I can't get it back. And I'm lucky because I can absorb that cost. And it was like long enough ago that you kind of went, okay, I'm just really mad now. Mm. But they came through. And when that Darth Vader helmet came in, I thought, the world really is ending because Anobos is starting to deliver their stuff. But they are delivering it. And that's the thing. They are fulfilling these orders. So that gives me a bit of hope. I still have one more outstanding pre-order with them. But I always, when I get that email from Anobos, I look at it and go, I want to order it, but I don't know if I want to wait 6 years for it, right?
Yeah.
So there is that. But those are the big ones that you think you'd learn your lesson, but I keep getting drawn back to that Anobos site and looking at all the cool stuff they have.
Just when you think you're out, they pull you back in.
That's
exactly.
Yeah. Now, I am, and I'm sure I speak for Baz here as well, profoundly jealous that you got to hold the baby Yoda. Yes. What was that moment like? Like, were you overcome with emotion? Like, I've seen a picture of George Lucas holding it, and it looks like, you know, like a proud granddad holding his grandchild for the first time. Like, was that, how did you feel holding baby Yoda?
What he's asking there, is it better or worse than holding your son's?
I mean, yeah, essentially, yes. That's the question.
I cried holding baby Yoda the first time. I cried. I cried so many times when I was on set for the visit. I cried. I cried when I held my kid. Yeah. I cry now with my kids, but not when I was holding him. No. When you're holding him, you're in awe. It is so entrenched in my psyche, like this species, and there's such a mystery around it. And then you see a young, like a child, an infant version of Yoda. It's not Yoda. We call it baby Yoda, but it's not.
Mm.
But when you see it, and it's so surreal, and it's so realistic from the weight to the way it moves. The eyes, which are just these big doe eyes, you can tell, you see why Werner Herzog lost his mind and said, do not dare turn this into a CGI monstrosity. Don't be cowards. Like, keep it, because he loved that thing too. And it's like, yeah, when you see it and you're holding it and it's there and you can pinch his little cheeks and touch his nose, it's incredible. And so, yeah, I cried like, you know, the single tear coming down. It's just like, and I didn't want to let him go. I was just like, how far can I run before they get me? And it's like, oh, then I'll never be able to come back. It's like, wow, I got banned by Lucasfilm. So, you know, that sort of takes over, and you kind of go, okay, I'm going to give him back now. But what a tremendous honor to just to have that opportunity. And I wasn't expecting that. Either. I was like, I'm going to be on Mandalorian set. I'm going to look and I'm going to see all these things. And to have that dropped, like that big secret, and to be entrusted with that was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, for sure.
Do you have any hot theories about who the child is and whose child he is and where he comes from and what his whole deal is?
Yeah. Well, we know, what do we know? I'm trying to be very scientific about this. And what do we know about the child so far? The child has Force capabilities, obviously, is very, very strong in the Force at that age. It's not Yoda, but they're looking to clone it, because that scientist said to be the doctor, he had the Kamino in the cloning emblem on him. I think they're trying to play with the idea of cloning Force sensitive beings so they can exploit them. Where does it come from? I think that's total speculation. Obviously, it's the same species as Yoda, but I mean, Lucas himself had said that they wanted to keep that as nebulous as possible. So there's very little information to go on, and so anything other than what we've been presented so far is would be purely conjecture on it. But I mean, we saw there was another Force being Yaddle in the prequels, right?
Mm.
And again, not much is. Information was given about her, except she disappeared.
Yeah, right?
She disappeared. So, like, I don't know what's the gestation period for the species, right? They, you know, they live up to 900 years, so maybe the span of what, 50 years for her to give birth.
Yeah,
and
then that'd another, be a good, you know, reason to just disappear from the Jedi Order when you're not supposed to form attachments.
Exactly. So there you go. It's like, oh, Yoda. Okay, someone got busy.
It's wild that we know like everything you could ever want to know about, you know, background alien number five in the cantina, but like we know so little about Yoda, like the most important alien character of them all.
And I love that. I really do, because it opens, it's so many more possibilities. You can go anywhere with that, because once you start establishing this, these backgrounds, and you really are, yes, you're defining that character, but there's such a specificity to it. And I think it really does limit you in terms of some storytelling. And I love it. We need a little bit more mystery in our lives. We don't need stuff explained to the nth degree.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's part of the vitriol around Snoke. It's like, well, where is he from? Who is he? What happened? This and that. And it's like, you don't really need to know that. I mean, it's a cool story to explore later on, but right now, what purpose does this character serve? When the Emperor finally shows up, we're just like, well, what's his backstory? Let's, you know, people just took it as he's the bad guy. He's in charge. I don't care how he came to power. It'd be really cool to explore one day, but this doesn't serve this story at all. So let's just move on and focus on this specific journey. Otherwise, you get movies that are like 7 hours long. Follow everybody's backstory. I know this and know that. It's, you become inundated with details.
There seemed to be a lot more trust in storytellers back in the, 30, 40 years ago than there is now, especially with the rise of the internet.
Yeah. And that's part of the problem too. It's like when you can access this information instantaneously, it becomes a double-edged sword, because it's great to have that access, but at the same time, it's I think people are losing the point of the storytelling right now, and it also gives rise to the advent of people saying, well, the story should go this way, or I'd like it to go this way, and if it doesn't, I'm going to hate it, and I'm going to let everybody know why I hate it, and I'm going to pull from every single resource as to why it's wrong and why we should never, ever watch this. I mean, you kind of go, you know, it is, at the end of the day, it's a bunch of people dressed up in plastic space armor running around.
Yeah.
We're just trying to have fun, right?
It's the old Harrison Ford quote, it's fake and it's in space, so.
Yeah.
Enjoy
the ride, man. There's so little to enjoy nowadays. Just sit back and enjoy as much as you can. Like, I'm not a huge fan of Rise of Skywalker, but we went and saw it in the movie theater, the whole family. And, you know, I enjoyed it for what it was. It's not my favorite Star Wars movie. People who loved it, great. I think that's amazing. You love that story? Good for you. I didn't. I loved Last Jedi. A lot of people are like, are you fucking crazy? No, I liked it because it was different. If I wanted to see the original trilogy, I would have watched the original trilogy. It was going in a different direction, and I was really excited for that. But it's really sort of telling, like, people want the comfort of something very familiar, but they want something different.
Yeah.
You can't have both, really.
Yeah.
But I think first season of Mandalorian really bridges that, where it's something new, but something very, very familiar. It is incredible storytelling. So hats off to Favreau and his team for that.
You mentioned that The Rise of Skywalker is not your favorite Star Wars movie. I mean, let's talk rankings for a sec. What is your favorite Star Wars movie? What's like the creme de la creme for you?
It's ever shifting. It's ever shifting. But originally, I mean, Empire Strikes Back was a big one, followed by A New Hope. I have to say Rogue One is creeping up the rankings. So I'd actually put Rogue One right behind A New Hope, just because what I loved about it was it gave the universe a sense of scale, that sort of grandness of this is, you know, the original trilogy was a group of plucky adventurers who were like fighting against a big bad guy. And it didn't really feel, for me at least, like it was a huge struggle, because it was just so small scale. It was just them. Whereas for Rogue One, I got a sense of the galactic stakes of all this happening, and the infighting and the rebellion at its very beginning, sort of like, and they're all really scared and they're unsure of what's going on. And there's been this insurgency that's been happening, and now they're like, they have this opportunity, but nobody wants to take a chance and blah, blah. And so I really like that. And the fact that, you know, they all died because they had to. that fulfilled for me a prerequisite is like, yeah, we don't hear from any of these guys later on, so they all gotta die.
Yeah.
And as long as that's there, yeah, it's cool. but Rogue One for me, I really did love that sort of that story within a story as part of the bigger universe. I think that's how that's a good example of expanded universe done great. Mm. So there's that, and then Return of the Jedi. And then I would have to go with, what else is there? I don't want to speak of the prequels, especially Episode 2.
That's Episode 2 is the one, my rankings change all the time as well, but the one constant is that Episode 2 is always at the bottom.
Yeah. It's Banta Pudu for me. I can't. It's just from really, I mean, the story isn't the best. The dialogue isn't the best. I feel for the performers in it, because they're by this point they're stuck in a green screen funhouse, and it's hard doing all that, and it's hard to have all that pressure on you to represent this. I get it, and it's not an enviable position to be in. That being said, I still didn't like the movie. So you can have empathy and still kind of go, that was a shitty movie. So that's on the bottom. There are moments, though, in each of the prequels that are like, make sitting through it totally worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
The lightsaber battle in Episode 1, good Lord. Episode 3, that lightsaber battle too, between the opening sequence where they're flying through the massive battle, like those set pieces, those are amazing. But the story is kind of like, okay. So there are great moments in that. And then in the new trilogy, I really like Last Jedi is my favorite of the new ones, followed by Force Awakens. And Rise of Skywalker is like, for me, from the bottom, it's Episode 2, Rise of Skywalker, Episode 1, 3. Oh no, Solo's got to kind of go down there. So Solo, yeah, Solo above Episode 3. And then I'd have to say Rogue One, A New Hope. Return of the Jedi is above Solo. Sorry. Anyways, that's my ranking. Yeah. But
I'm gonna listen back to this later and try and piece together what the numbers are.
Going from the bottom, reaching up to the top is like Empire's at the top. Episode 2's at the bottom. In between fluctuates depending on my mood, but the top few are still there. Yeah, The Last Jedi is still actually, I still really liked it. And I love how everybody points out, what about when they go to, what the hell's the name of that planet? Canto Bite. And they say, wow, what about that? It's like, yeah, but what about, like, no movie is perfect. Yeah. I get it. And yeah, they could have trimmed it, but they were laying down the groundwork for something bigger, I think. And it was a look at a different part of that universe that was clean and shiny and affluent and, you know, I think that was worth a look. I think it was, yeah, a little bit too long, but no movie is perfect. But I mean, I always turn around and say, well, what about Rise of Skywalker and all the fan service? Because like a lot of that was just, it felt like it was tacked on just as a little, And if you cut all those little fan servicey moments, the movie would have been 20 minutes shorter.
Mm.
And I think it would have been a lot tighter. Mm. There's a way of doing it where you kind of go, oh, that's really cool for the fans, without it being a little bit too, not desperate, but there was this overwhelming, I felt the sense of this movie was trying too hard to sort of make the fanboys happy.
Yeah.
Like, please like us, I'll give you this. Please like us, look, there's Sean Williams. Oh, please like us, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. Look at all this really cool stuff that you guys want to geek out about. We're giving it to you. Hey, Chewie, here's your medal. You kind of go, oh, fuck, come on, guys. Like, let's go. Like, just be a little bit more sparing with that. And that's just me as a fan. Sort of my initial reaction was like, I get it. You want to make the fans happy.
Mm.
But I think they just, and I've been that guy, the guy who's like too eager to please, in anything. It's like, I want you to like me. So I'm going to do it. And that sort of, it feels desperate. And like when you meet people like that, you kind of go, okay, just that's really nice. Just back away.
Yeah,
and, I'm sure you're really nice, but and you it's kind of cringy when you see that, because it's just, it seems a bit heavy-handed and too eager to please. And there's no self-assuredness in storytelling when that happens. Mm. And I think if they just sort of stuck with their guns and kind of gone, we're going to go in this direction, you're going to come along and we're going to win you over, because the storytelling is going to be really good.
Yeah.
I saw a quote recently by someone who, I wish I could remember who it was off the top of my head, but it was someone who worked on The Rise of Skywalker, and they were talking about JJ, and they were saying, like, you know, during the writing process and everything, like at every stage of the process, it was like he had like an invisible fan over standing over his shoulder, kind of whispering, like, I like this, I don't like this. And I think like that person was someone who worked with JJ, and they meant that as a compliment, like, oh, you know, right. he's really trying to please the fans. And it's like, yeah, no, like you can tell, but also that's probably responsible for a lot of the things I don't like as much about the movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a fine balance. I mean, and I honestly, I feel for them because Carrie Fisher dies.
Oh, 100%.
And she was supposed to be a huge, huge part of that. So you're handcuffed by that. The critical reaction to The Last Jedi was tremendous, but the fans, and let's be honest, it was a small but very, very vocal group of haters who, it was like having the Russians interfere with an election, right? Yeah. You get enough bots spewing this shit, everybody starts to believe it. And it's like, I was at a comic book store. I was at a comic book store in New York, and I caught this kid. He was a teenager, basically, and he was parroting almost word for word this article that was shitting all over The Last Jedi. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to stop and say, like, I read that article too, but you're making it sound like it's your own opinion and it's fact. But what do you really think? Because it's easy to sort of say, list all these bullet points, but what's behind that? Like, actually give it some critical thought and say, so you didn't like Canto Bight. Why didn't you like Canto Bight? What about their journey to Canto Bight really, really turned you off the movie? Like, what? Let's be critical about this instead of listing off a bunch of, you know, hate-filled points. And that's what happens. It's like we've come to this, we're at this point now where we'll read an article that's we kind of agree with, and we'll just spew the points, but we don't know why you agree with it. And that's fine. You can agree with it, but you have to know why. Like, what is it about this? And so we can have a better conversation about the merits of a movie or not. But I get some people, I fucking hate that movie. Fucking stupid. It's like, okay, why?
Mm. Yeah. Why?
Let's talk about that. And, you know, so for Rise of Skywalker, I'd love to sit down. I have a civil discussion with people about what I... where I felt disappointed, but again, that's me. But I do understand too, man, making these movies, it's an unenviable position to be in. On one hand, it's so cool because you're doing Star Wars and that should carry you through. You should be excited for that. But it's when you start to carry the weight of all the haters and that, you lose sight of what this story is about, what the strength of these characters are, and what the best storytelling is. Because if you focus more on appeasing people instead of telling your story, you're lost.
That's it. Mm.
Yeah, it's funny, like with Last Jedi, like Canto Bight has sort of become this shorthand for, like, I mean, Baz and I are both Last Jedi fans, and Canto Bight has sort of become this shorthand for, like, oh, you know, people just say, like, oh, I don't like it because, you know, there's stuff like the Canto Bight sequence. Yeah. And it's just like, everyone just accepts, like, oh, yeah, the Canto Bight sequence is bad. And like, I've always kind of been like from day, like when we did our Last Jedi, like, you know, our review episode and stuff, like, I really liked the Canto Bight sequence. Like, I thought it was sort of this fun, it's almost like an Indiana Jones, like it's very sort of Spielbergian, like the romp through the city and stuff. And it's like, it's, as you said before, it's a side of the galaxy. We don't see that often. Like, it's baffling to me how it's become the thing that everyone just, like, even if you like the movie, it's become the thing that everyone just agrees is bad. And I feel like it's that groupthink that you're talking about where people don't actually know why they think that in some cases.
Thematically, that sequence is really important to show you what the Resistance is fighting for, to show you what the 1% are doing to fuel war. And, you know, it's really got all that going for it. And some great production design too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What's not to like? Yeah.
But I think you kind of tweaked on it because it's like, it's the 1% and... you know, and it's what they're doing and like who's shaping this narrative against this sort of parable of, or this, you know, these parallels of what's going on today versus what's going on in a galaxy far, far away. Who's starting this? Is it because As fans, we don't want to be reminded that this is actually happening now. And so I'm going to push back against it. Or is it, I mean, the level of misogyny directed towards The Last Jedi too is astounding as well. Like from Admiral Holdo to like, oh, Poe Dameron's being an asshole. He's dumb. And I don't like how they dumbed him down and made him not think or this or that. It's like, no, I think they stay very true to his character. He's very impulsive. He's thinking, he doesn't think, tactically in that sense, in the long game. He's just looking at the very, very small. So that is beginning assault on the dreadnought, for example, him being so short-sighted and very narrowly focused on, we got to take out this one thing, because that's what he knows how he can fight back. And his patience isn't there. And his arc as a character to grow into this leader, that you need that sequence to sort of show that he's making bad decisions because he's impulsive and because he really wants to help and he's impatient. And so you need that. You need him sort of fighting. But, you know, the big question is, well, why didn't Holdo just tell him? Like, that's so dumb. It's bad storytelling. Now he's going off on this adventure and he sent off Finn and Rose. And why is this dumb? And my argument is always, well, she's an admiral. And he's a captain. She doesn't have to tell him jack shit. Have you ever been in the military? Like, it's basically as simple as that. But there's this weird pushback about having female characters other than Princess Leia in power. You know, and with Rose and that whole budding relationship with Rose and Finn, like her saying, you know, we don't win by killing the things that we just destroying things we hate. We win by saving the things we love. Why that particular sentiment was so vilified, and the fact that, you know, she gives him a kiss afterwards, it's totally plausible that she's fallen in love with him, because right from the beginning, when she recognizes him, you can tell she's already starting to idolize him. She's like,
oh yeah, this is total hero worship.
Yeah. And so that makes sense to me. But people are like, oh, it's so terrible. Because compassion is being shown. Because you have an Asian woman expressing any sort of feeling towards, you know, one of your characters who's supposed to be in love with Rey. It's like, well, okay, you know, it's a galaxy far, far away, and it is mirroring some parts of real life, but I think it's totally believable. Those things, Last Jedi for me was exciting because we were exploring all these different themes with different characters, and they're going on different journeys. I didn't want to see the same Han Solo character arc. I didn't want to see the Luke Skywalker arc. I wanted to see it go in different directions because we've done those stories before.
Yeah. And so the great thing about how that film handled Luke was as well, everyone complained about, you know, they said Luke would never do that. Luke would never run away. I'm like, look at what Ben Kenobi and Yoda both did. They screwed up. Moat Planet, his domed hut. He did exactly what all the other Jedi did.
Yeah. That's what he was taught to do. Isn't that what you're supposed to do?
but his story was great. It's just so, you know, the elegy of a man who's, you know, done so much in his life, come to the end of it and stumbled, but got back up again and saved the day.
The way that he does that, the way that he helps save the day at the end, I mean, to me, that's like the ultimate Jedi moment. This is using the Force, you know,
for knowledge, I'm blanking on the quote. Never for attack.
Yeah, and the other thing about, you know, there are ways to win other than fighting, you know. And so, you know, that's that. Like, that's a guy living those lessons and sort of that's the ultimate, you know, he's winning through smarts rather than, you know, actually physically hurting Kylo.
And that's the thing. He knows that's the best way he can help the Resistance is by doing that. That sort of, because, you know, it's easier to kill a man than a legend, you know, and that's his way of thinking. Like he, like this, and they play that. It's the story of Luke Skywalker and how he stood up to the First Order, and it gives people hope. And so that's something that you can't kill that idea. That's why they're so hard to fight against. Mark Hamill, though, I mean, I love him, but he's the one that kind of started this whole, I hate how they went with Luke Skywalker, because he complained about it, right?
Yes.
And like, when you have legions of loyal fans who like, here, he's unhappy, so I'm unhappy, and so I will defend his point of view about this to the end. That's what started this whole hate train, I think. And he's since recanted and he's gone, actually, no. And I understand, as an actor, you play a character for a long time and then somebody comes in and says, no, you're going to be doing this instead. I get the pushback. If somebody came in and said, no, Appa's going to do this now. And I go, well, that's really out of character for Appa. Why would Appa do that? I've played Appa now for more than 10 years. Why are you? And then, like, for Mark Hamill, more than 30 years. Not playing Appa, but playing Luke
Skywalker. That would be amazing.
Oh, my God.
Two tickets, please.
I don't need to go to Toshi's to buy some power converters anymore because we have them in the back. So, I don't know where it's going. Oh, yeah. So he started this whole thing, and then he's since gone back and gone, oh, no, actually, you know what? This is actually a really, really great way of continuing this character on it and tying a ball on the end of it and sort of letting it go. It's incredible when you're acting the ego as a human being, how that plays into what you do. You have to have a healthy amount of ego in this business. Otherwise, it'll chew you up and destroy you. And it's that fine line where even there are points where, you know, I've been on set and I vehemently disagree with what the director's saying, what I should be doing. But my job, much like Mark Hamill said, is to make it work. And he did that. He went on record saying him and Rian Johnson, they fought over this or that, but his job was to make it work, and he did it. And he grumbled about it afterwards. And the difference between him and me is he's got a platform of millions of loyal fans. If I bitch about something, I've got like tiniest fraction of it. And so it won't have the same weight. And so I think he inadvertently, in terms of airing his frustrations about what he was doing, ignited all of this hate train. And it, like, that's hard. One of the main stars voices disapproval in terms of how his character's portrayed. That gets everybody, you know, their backs all up and they're all like, okay, what's going on? This is supposed to be, this is like, what are they doing with Luke? And that's what started it. And what people forget is he went on record again after saying, I was wrong. This is the great way. This is how it should be. It's poignant. It's powerful. It's not how he expected it to be, which is really the gripe initially. But I think it's way more powerful than if Luke Skywalker actually stood there and fought with Kylo Ren and did all that stuff. It just doesn't have the same impact. And so Mark Hamill was the one that's kind of like got this whole thing going inadvertently against Last Jedi. And it's a lesson to be learned in terms of the power of speaking up about something before the finished product is out there. Like if he'd seen a finished cut of it, that would have been interesting too before he published any of that stuff. But we're all human beings and it happens.
Well, that's the thing. Like, there's a level of nuance there, though, that a lot of people don't seem capable of. Like, it's like, I'm going to take this thing that he said, and I'm going to take this line out of context, and that now lives forever as like Mark Hamill's opinion about the movie. And it's like, yeah, but like most of the time that he said anything negative about the movie, if you listen to the whole interview or you look at the whole tweet thread or whatever, he always talks about like what a genius Rian Johnson is. He always talks about the fact that, you know, he's not a writer. Rian Johnson's is a writer, and that, you know, once he saw the movie, he realized that Rian was right. And it's disappointing that, yeah, people don't sort of want to acknowledge that. They just want to take, it's that whole cognitive bias of like, well, this thing that he says is the same thing that I think, so I'm just going to listen to that bit and ignore the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we have anti-vaxxers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Surely not anymore after all this.
Well, you would be surprised. Now, one other, I've just realized we've taken up way more of your time than I meant to, so I apologize for that.
Oh my God. This feels like we've been talking for like 10 minutes. I don't know how you're going to edit this down.
Oh, but I don't know if I will. I think not. Give people the uncut, uncut upper.
Yes.
Just a few things quickly though. I mean, I noticed in your, one of your videos, you had the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon poster behind you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of my favorite movies. First off, are you a fan of that sort of like wuxia, you know, filmmaking in general? And secondly, how much are you looking forward to seeing your on-screen son kick ass in the Master of Kung
Fu? Well, he's in Australia right now.
Yeah, right. He's stuck here while all this is going on.
I think so. I think last I heard he's still stuck there. Although they have been repatriating a lot of Canadians, so they had an opportunity to come back. He's just got to self-isolate for 2 weeks. I don't know. I think he's still there. with response to the first question, growing up, these were the movies that were kind of, that were on TV that was like, wow, and were always subtitled. Mm-hmm. And I never really understood what was going on, but I loved the set pieces and the action in it. But could never really fully appreciate it till I got older. Mm. And it's this funny thing where, you know, access to those kinds of movies sort of dried up for a while, or actively wasn't looking for them unless they were playing in a rep theater or this or that. And it became way more mainstream. And then this came out and sort of reignited, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, just kind of reignited the passion in that particular genre, just because it was done. I mean, it's beautifully shot. It's poetically written. The performances are sublime. Ang Lee is wonderful. And it was really great to see an Asian, a Chinese director really, really put his stamp on Hollywood. And it opened up so many doors for him to direct all different types of movies, which I think is tremendous. Mm. So, love that movie to death. I actually started going out and trying to track down more. And then you realize it's like you're opening up Pandora's box because there's such amazing content out there, right?
Amazon Prime alone. I don't know what you guys like. I think we have different, there's different things on each server internationally or whatever. But just Amazon Prime, there's like hundreds of those like Chang Chae, you know, like, and I love that stuff. Like, you know, One Armed Swordsman, like Come Drink With Me, or like Dragon Inn, all that sort. But then it's like intimidating. I could spend this whole isolation period just watching those old, like, you know, Wuxia and Kung Fu movies. And like, you still wouldn't get through just even the good stuff before you even get to the filler.
Right. No, absolutely. And it's really funny because it makes you appreciate the other movies too, because there was, I rediscovered, Iron Monkey, you know, because I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about this movie. And it's just watching it and then rediscovering these fantastic martial artists who, like, you know, like Donnie Yen again, like rediscovering him was just like, oh, right. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, that was him in that was him in Blade 2. Criminally underused, right? Mm. And then you start going through and you slip down the rabbit hole of stuff. Absolutely. There's so much. And that's the wonderful thing about a movie like that, making it big in North America, it is a gateway. Mm. And it really opens up the floodgates for anybody who's interested in that genre to go down and become more of a world traveler in terms of their what they're being exposed to cinematically, at least, right? And it's like everything else. You can see, when you watch some of these older movies too, you can see how far the genre has gone and how polished, really, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is in terms of the production values and just how they've even choreographed some of the fight scenes in there, like fighting on the bamboo stalks going there. Like, that's not the first bamboo stalk move, you know, scene I've ever seen, you know, a fight in the on the treetops. I've seen that before, just not as beautifully shot.
Exactly.
You know?
And I feel like that sums up the whole movie, is like, oh, this is an homage to stuff I've seen before, but I've never seen it done on this level. And, you know, it's the same with the Zhang Yimou, you know, the movie like Hero and the House of Flying Daggers, like all that stuff. That Firstly, Golden Flower, those movies that followed, like, it sort of, as you say, it seemed to open the floodgates for a little while, at least for this, like, this stream of those types of movies, which was awesome.
The thing about Simu with Shang-Chi, it's interesting too, because the pandemic stopped production on everything. So the last time I spoke to him, they were about 3/4 of the way through filming and they stopped. So there's going to be a delay. I mean, they're delaying so many movies right now. Like, I think, what's that? Maverick, Top Gun 2, that's been pushed.
Yeah,
and I was really actually quite excited to see that.
Same.
And so these movies, they're all being pushed. So we got to wait. I mean, I think Shang-Chi was supposed to be released in 2021 anyway. So we're probably looking another year, right, at least. Well, I mean, man, that's me talking out of my ass. Yes, a year, because I'm closely associated with the movie. We're very excited. I mean, Simu's always wanted to be a Marvel superhero. He's never hidden that fact. And whenever you see somebody get an opportunity to live their dream, you can't not be happy for them, right?
Yeah.
And so we're all excited, because this is serious next level shit. You know, you're like, whoa, you know, little Canadian TV series that's blowing up on Netflix is one thing and it's great. But like that's a world stage. Marvel, that's a brand, right? Mm, that is like, yeah. Boom, these are superstars that get up there. So I have to admit, I never read the comic books about mm-hmm. Shang-Chi. I didn't, and I'm purposefully just like, I'm not going to, because I don't want to get cluttered sometimes with, oh, well, you know, in the comic books, this actually happened. This, I think.
How funny would that be, though? You on the set just kind of like throwing shade at Simu, like, now I can't help but notice that in the comic books. Like,
yeah, way to go. That wasn't his costume in the book, you nerd. And I think there's already going to be a big enough weight of expectation on that movie. Mm. Just because, and this happens, I remember reading this, I think, fuck, that's so unfair. Black Panther did tremendously well, but they didn't specifically set off to make Black Panther, to make it this cultural thing for black audiences. They took this character and they did it. Marvel did all the right things from all the designers. Everyone was black. And they gave him carte blanche to sort of create this world. It was great. But it was never meant to represent the black community. You know, it was like part of the canon. And with the success of that, and I think they were all really, really surprised at how well it was received. And it did, you know, gangbusters that way. My fear is, and this is my fear, that they're kind of doing the same with Shang-Chi, except they're going now, well, this is going to be to the Asian community what Black Panther was to the black community. Make a movie. Make an awesome movie. Make a great movie. Don't say this is going to be to them. Just make a great movie that's going to be that to everyone and not just a specific community. Because then the weight of expectation is on there and it's unfair. And we've already seen what that can do to filmmakers. And so that's my big fear, is I want people to judge the movie based on, you know, is it a good superhero movie? Yeah, man. That's the through line. Black Panther, is it a good superhero movie? You know, this is what you want. You don't want to go, yeah, it's a great Asian superhero movie. It's like, the fuck does that mean? Like a great Asian, like, you don't want that. You want it to be a great superhero movie.
If you build it, they will come.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. And I think it's like, you let his talent shine. You let all their talents shine. Don't put all this weight of expectation on his shoulders and just let them do the best movie they can. And that's why I don't want to read any of the Shang-Chi stuff, because I want to go in fresh with this character. I don't want to have that sort of, well, they did it better in the comic. I don't want that shit. I don't want it. I want to be able to watch this movie and enjoy it and see my friend up there kill it. So I guess I really should have checked it because I didn't. I feel like a bad friend now. Oh my god. But we're all super stoked for it, and we're bummed that we have to wait another year to see it. But he's safe, which is the important thing, and he's healthy. And so, you know, life will move on. We'll go on once this is all over, and we might have to wait a little bit, but we'll get it.
Is it clear yet how the pandemic will have affected seasons 5 and 6 of Kim's Convenience?
Yeah, not yet. It's moving. Everything's all in motion right now. That's a phrase I keep hearing. We were blessed enough to get 2 more seasons. That's an incredible show of faith, especially in a time where nothing is for sure right now. So we're tremendously happy that CBC has decided to invest in us in that way. Right now, I think our prime minister basically said, things are looking good, but we don't want to rush back into things. So we're looking at least another month before we even start loosening up restrictions. We should have been in pre-production for Kim's by now. The writers are still writing. They're doing Zoom meetings. I think production, what they're working with is the different departments in terms of getting as much done beforehand, so that, and perhaps so that when we do come back to work, they can just get going on it and be really efficient. But it's going to be a different world, because there's going to be distancing rules, cleaning stations, different rules of conduct in terms of how close you can be to each other when you're shooting a scene. There's got to be screenings. If anybody shows any symptoms, of getting sick and what the procedure is going to be about that. So I think like anything, like everything else, things are just going to get sort of pushed. And that's all I know right now.
Mm. Yeah. And this is obviously, you know, this is a character you've been playing, as you said, for years since what, 2011 on stage, but you were developing him, like you were developing him since what, 2005?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, where do you kind of see Mr. Kim going in these next two seasons?
Well, for those of you who don't know, they dropped, like for the season four finale, they dropped a big
Actually, you know what? I immediately regret asking you this question because I haven't seen
the
finale yet.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't say it then. You'll see it. So when it happens and you see it, you kind of go, oh my God. So that's going to be really interesting storyline to sort of follow as it goes through. Mm-hmm. I continually adore seeing Appa put himself in these horrible situations because of what he says and what he does. He is a man who at the core of his being wants to help, but also wants to be right. Mm-hmm. And that gets him into a lot of trouble. But the other thing about him that I love is his capacity to learn and to change. It's not overnight in a lot of cases, but he's open enough to realize that his actions, his words have consequences, and he doesn't want to do any harm. And I think that's what endears him to a lot of people, is they can see a lot of themselves, their parents, in his actions, because he does things that are so wrong, but he always tries to make amends for them, which is great. And it's never really out of a place of malice when he does things. It's because he's either truly confused, or he's ignorant, or he's got a preconceived conception of how things should be. But once he's faced with the reality of what's going on, then he's smart enough to change. So yeah, I'd love to see that continue.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, Kim's is a show about family, and, you know, essentially so is Star Wars, you know, and not always biological family. Like sometimes in Star Wars and in Kim's, you know, if you look at the relationship between Jung and Kimchi, you know, it's a family you choose as well. So I guess that's something that they've sort of got in common in their DNA.
Absolutely. Wow, we just got compared to Star Wars. I love that.
Now, on that note, we should let you go because this is getting out of hand. But
17-hour podcast.
I don't know about you guys. Yeah. I've had so much fun doing this.
Oh, me too.
Now, where can the people find you? I mean, obviously, we talked about the YouTube channel before. Bitter Asian Dude Inc. is the name of the channel. Yep. Where does that name come from? By the way, that is great.
That's my Twitter handle. Mm. So you can also find me on Twitter at Bitter Asian Dude. All one word, not Angry Asian Man. Phil keeps getting my stuff sometimes. Bitter Asian Dude, all one word. And that started in my youth. I was a very angry, bitter Asian because I always felt like I was getting jobbed in terms of railroaded out of job opportunities. My lot in life, I was not very successful in relationships either. It was just the angry young man sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And couple that with him being like of color and thinking the man's out to get him type thing. Mm. And so when it came time to just sort of pick a Twitter handle, because that was like, I think 2007, mm-hmm. I joined Twitter, or 2009. I just wanted something that was kind of funny and a little bit more indicative of where I was. And I wanted to be memorable, really. And so I picked Bitter Asian Dude. It wasn't taken. I was going to take Angry Asian Dude, actually, at first. But then there was already Angry Asian Man. So I was like, oh, okay, I want to change it. So that's why I picked it. So that's where that came out, Bitter Asian Dude. I'm no longer bitter, which is a great thing because it is a constant reminder of to always be grateful and to always remember where you came from, and to learn from your mistakes and to grow from them.
It's like Appa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Bitter Asian Dude. I'm on Instagram as Angry Appa. It used to be Bitter Asian Dude, but then there was that huge, like, Instagram is stealing your information. If you don't delete your accounts right away, blah, blah, blah. I bought into that. Like,
oh no.
So I deleted the account. And once that happens, you can't pick that name again. Mm. And so I switched it to Angry Appa. And it's, in fact, I was going to switch over my Twitter to that as well. But then I was just too lazy and I was like, no, but I have an Angry Appa Twitter account. It's got like one follower, me. So, and I have a Facebook page, Paul Sun Hyung Lee, on Facebook. And Bitter Asian Dude Inc. is my new YouTube channel.
Awesome. And that Facebook page as well for people, if people want to see you in costume, I mean, I suppose that's somewhere they can see that if they head there and scroll through the photo.
Yeah. Instagram is the best place. If you want to see
of
my
course.
Costume,
yeah.
Scroll through my Insta. And in fact, I think some of the other segments that I'm going to have to on Bitter Asian Dude are, I'm going to do a walkthrough of some of my costumes. The Proton Pack's going to get its own special. I'm going to be featuring some of the props that I built. This is a DL-44.
Oh,
Return of the Jedi. It's all metal. It's really heavy. And this is based off of a BB gun build, and like these are machine parts that I got from a vendor.
Oh my gosh.
Field Marshal. And it's as a nerd, you're like, I'm holding Han Solo's blaster.
Yeah. For the people who can't obviously see this on the podcast, he's holding it. It looks like it's a screen used prop. I mean, it's amazing.
It's heavy. And it's like, I actually went out and for Novos, I bought the Han Solo belt rig, I put it in, and it was like, this is so uncomfortable. The gun is so heavy and it's pulling the belt down. So real life versus screen used, right?
Hashtag Harrison Ford problems.
Exactly.
And obviously as well, if people haven't seen Kim's Convenience, you know, first off, address that, fix that. You gotta check it out. It's amazing. The first four seasons now, all four seasons, on Netflix internationally. I think they're like pretty much everywhere around the world. You can probably see them on Netflix, I would imagine.
I think it's South America, for whatever reason, is the only region that doesn't have it.
Okay.
I had a fan like say, I can't get it. I'm like, I'm sorry, it's not up to me.
Well, you might have to practice some dark torrenting arts in South America, but everywhere else, you should be able to check it out on Netflix. And you can follow us, obviously, we're at Force Material on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We mainly use Twitter. If people are looking for Baz, he's just Baz McAllister on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm Rowan_Williams on Twitter. You can also drop us a line at forcematerial@gmail.com. Let us know what you thought of this episode or any other episodes. And if you're so inclined and you've been listening to this and having a good time, feel free to hit us up and drop us the old 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. We certainly wouldn't object. Yeah, I mean, again, thanks so much for joining us. This has been so much fun. I'm Rowan Williams.
Baz McAllister.
And I'm Paul Sun Hyung Lee. And I eat you up. Okay, see you.